Did you read this article? Chicago Tribune. First of all, the very way they cover it, to receive controversial medication. Ivermectin has been used for decades with millions of people. It's about as safe a drug as exists in the world. Controversial. Some people were hurt when they used a form of it for horses. Oh, am I supposed to crack up? Is that a joke? Large doses can be fatal. Large doses of what cannot be fatal? Large doses of aspirin can be fatal. You know how many Americans died because of the FDA opposition and the CDC opposition to ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and zinc? There are epidemiologists who believe most of those who died would have lived had they been given these simple, safe drugs. This is the age of the irrational, led by the media, the despicable, lying, fraudulent media, who are killers, absolute killers, in aiding and abetting this medical fraud. Another federal agency, the National Institutes of Health, has taken a more measured stance, saying that while the drug is well tolerated when used for its intended purposes, there isn't enough information to allow a recommendation for or against using it to treat COVID-19. Wait, so it's well tolerated. So if it's well tolerated, what's the risk? Wait, it's well tolerated if you have a lupus, but it's not well tolerated if you have COVID? Elmhurst Hospital's attorney, Joseph Monahan, said at the hearing, none of its doctors would agree to administer ivermectin for COVID-19. Now you know why I have contempt for the medical profession? That is example 56. The percentage of doctors who were fools is so large that it is painful to me. Painful. I was not aware of it. It's so sad. It is such sad news. Not one doctor in the hospital would administer to a comatose COVID patient on a ventilator. The ventilator is safe. You hear? This is safe. The ventilator, the kiss of death ventilator is safe, but ivermectin isn't. An internal ethics panel concluded its use could not be justified. Are you listening to this? Elmhurst Hospital's internal ethics panel concluded its use could not be justified on a comatose COVID ventilated patient? He argued that judges should not overrule medical decisions. Oh, God forbid. The court doesn't have the authority to order a medical corporation to use particular medications, particularly when it's an off-label use, particularly when the federal government has said it could be dangerous. Whoa. Judge James Orrell pointed to an affidavit from Fipe's physician. Fipe, again, is the woman who's comatose. Dr. William Crevier of Orland Park, in which the doctor said he has used the drug successfully for COVID-19 patients since last year. If Elmhurst doctors don't want to use ivermectin, the judge said, they should allow Crevier to administer it. Right? Why is that doctor less holy than the hospital's doctors, who are cowards? Why wouldn't this be tried if she's not improving? The judge said. Yes. Why wouldn't we try the ivermectin? So masks after vaccine outside should be worn, but ivermectin on a patient on a ventilator should not be used. This is the sick world induced by the medical profession that has lost its soul. Is there something wrong with you? If you think this is this shows you that we should have faith in the CIA. The CIA is actually not, at least at the top, is so corrupt that it's not merely a matter of utter and total incompetence. It is a matter of, it might be an arm of the Democratic Party now, which is, this is police state type stuff. I never thought I would talk like this in my life. Never. America veering toward a police state? See what happened to Rudy Giuliani? You don't think that that's reminiscent of a police state? Whatever you think of Rudy Giuliani? Or the people still in prison from July 16th? Wasn't it July 16th? From June, what was it? June? What was the day of the riot at the Capitol?
January 6th.
Oh, yeah, January what?
6th.
January 6th, right. In solitary confinement in some cases, while they're releasing murderers and rapists by the scores in L.A. And other places with woke district attorneys. So I want you to know the good news is that at least on Twitter, there are more than 3 million views of this recruiting commercial by the CIA. I'm going to play it for you. It shows a woman walking through the halls of the CIA. Take it away, Sean.
When I was 17, I quoted Zora Neale Hurston's How It Feels to Be Colored Me in my college application essay. The line that spoke to me stated simply, I am not tragically colored. There is no sorrow dammed up in my soul nor lurking behind my eyes. I do not mind at all. At 17, I had no idea what life would bring, but Zora's sentiment articulated so beautifully how I felt as a daughter of immigrants then and now. Nothing about me was or is tragic. I am perfectly made. I can wax eloquent on complex legal issues in English while also belting Guayaquil de mis amores in Spanish. I can change a diaper with one hand and console a crying toddler with the other.
Okay, let's hold up there for a second. So if I showed this to you, what would you think it was an ad for or a message for? Isn't that interesting? It's a very important question. I would just think basically it was a celebration of this woman's life. And I don't know what else it would or if it ended with, and that's why I went to college, and so should you. Yeah, you were a college recruiting. Yeah, college recruit. By the way, some of the language is so odd to me, and I'm not blaming this woman, but I was made perfect. Who walks around thinking they were made perfect?
So there's nothing you don't.
I didn't think I was made perfect as a kid because my mother took me to the Husky section in the boys' clothing store. I knew I was imperfect from a very early age. Okay, yeah, it's what it is. It looks like a recruit. So, and you, who can do all this while being a person of a woman, of course, a woman of color, you belong at Hofstra University. Okay, continue.
I'm a woman of color. I am a mom. I am a cisgender millennial who's been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder.
Okay, this one, that's a key point there. I'm a cisgender millennial who has been diagnosed with what? What was the word?
General anxiety
disorder.
I am a cisgender millennial who's been diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder.
Okay, hold on. Hold it there. When do I do this? Okay, I got to remember that. Cisgender millennial with generalized anxiety disorder. And I do belong at Hofstra. Intersectional and...
I am intersectional, but my existence is not a box-checking exercise.
Wait a minute.
I am a walking declaration.
Wait. Of course it is. She just checked the boxes of cisgender, millennial, etc., and person of color and child of immigrant. She's not a box checker? Who wrote this ad? She should have rejected it. Whoever she is. I don't care who she is. I'm not picking on her. I'm picking on the CIA. I'm not a box checker. The whole damn ad is box checking. Did you just do thumbs up, Sean? With regard to what? Oh, the point I just made. Wow. Whoa. I don't get that very often from you. It was the thumb, right? Okay. Continue, please.
I am a walking declaration, a woman whose inflection does not rise at the end of her sentences, suggesting that a question has been asked. I did not sneak into CIA. My employment was not and is not the result of a fluke or slip through the cracks. I earned my way in, and I earned my way up the ranks of this organization. I am educated, qualified, and competent, and sometimes I struggle. I struggle feeling like I could do more, be more to my two sons, and I struggle leaving the office when I feel there's so much more to do.
By the way, you'll notice the absence, I think, I don't remember the whole ad, but so far, I could do more. And you would think the logical conclusion to the sentence is, for my country. Isn't that why you're in the CIA? For my two sons. I think it's beautiful. But what does that have to do with the CIA? What did Gutfeld say? That's Gutfeld's a riot. They replaced CIA with TMI. That is good. Continue, please.
I used to struggle with imposter syndrome, but at 36, I refuse to internalize misguided patriarchal ideas of what a woman can or should be.
Oh, good. Well, at least they got an attack on the patriarchy. No woke ad is complete without an attack on the patriarchy. I don't know what the imposter is, because I'm not acting. You explained to me intersectionality, which I still don't quite get why I'm intersectional, but I will explain to you this one. What is it that you're asking me again?
Imposter.
So she is not acting in a fake way that the patriarchy would want her to act. By the way, if you had to bet your savings, does she have a husband?
No, if I had to bet my savings,
yeah.
I would say
no too.
Yeah.
Right. Go ahead, please. Oh, all right. We have a few seconds left. This is what the CIA has become. Just remember, whatever the left touches, it destroys. In this case, it is the senator from the state of Missouri, Senator Josh Hawley. And Senator Josh Hawley has written this book, which I am delighted to tell you is one of the best-selling books in the United States, and we will make it even better. The Tyranny of Big Tech. Senator Hawley, you, sir, have courage, the rarest of all the good traits.
Well, thank you so much, Dennis. I appreciate that. That's kind of you to say.
Well, it's accurate, and I don't know the origins of courage. It's a dilemma to me. I try to figure it out. In any event, just tell everybody quickly what happened with Simon & Schuster.
Well, they were the original publishers of this book. They're the ones that initially signed it up, commissioned it. And then they, back in January, they canceled it. They bowed to the woke mob, a Twitter mob. They started a petition to get me deplatformed, to have the book canceled. And Simon & Schuster gave in to them. I read about it in a press release. They didn't even alert me personally. They just read about it in the press release. They said, you know, we're going to cancel this book. We don't think that Holly ought to be able to publish this with us anymore. They basically accused me of inciting a riot at the Capitol, which is totally false. And they know it's false, by the way, but they didn't have the guts to stand up to the mob. In fact, they kind of became part of the woke mob. And here's my view on that, on cancel culture, is I refuse to go along with it, Dennis. I refuse to bow down to it. I refuse to be co-opted by it. I refuse to cooperate with it. And so I'm delighted this book found another publisher, and now people can read it for themselves.
Well, it's doing magnificently. And by the way, just for the record, we share publishers, Regnery. And your book is doing great. The assault on free speech is unprecedented in American history. Is that fair to say?
I think it is fair to say. Absolutely. I suppose you could look back to, in our early days, the Alien and Sedition Acts, where you had the government try to criminalize a certain amount of dissent, which, by the way, is what the Democrats would like to do today. If they could pass legislation like that today, they absolutely would. But what they figured out is they can use the tech companies to do the same thing and not have to pass any laws at all and not have to survive First Amendment scrutiny, and that's why big tech is so dangerous.
That's exactly right. That's also unprecedented. I testified at the Senate because Prager University was sort of the first well-known censored item on big tech, so your colleague Senator Cruz invited me to testify. And they asked the representative of Google, which runs YouTube, why did you take down Mr. Prager's video on the Ten Commandments? Senator, if I left you in a room alone for a week and told you you can't come out until you figure out what Google answered, you would not get the answer. So I will tell you, it's odd, you could actually watch it, believe it or not. This is on YouTube when I testified there. So Senator Cruz goes to the man and said, why did you take down Mr. Prager's video on the Ten Commandments? And his answer was, because it mentioned murder.
That sounds about right for big tech. That's about their level of historical and biblical literacy.
Right, exactly right. Well, the $64,000 question is, what can be done? Did I lose the senator?
I'm sorry. I've got you now. You said the $64,000 question
is, what can be done?
Well, I think what we've got to do is we have to break them up. Dennis, we've seen this before in our history in terms of companies becoming monopolies and trying to exert political power. Now, we've never seen, as we were just talking about, companies with this size and this amount of power before. This is truly new. But we know what the solutions are. The solution is to break up monopoly power, to make sure that these monopolies can't exercise political control. And that's what we have to do. We have to put the people back in control of their own speech, of their own lives, of their own data, personal property. So I think we have to break them up. And we've also got to give people the right to sue. You know, for instance, take you and your platform. I think if these big tech companies, if they come and try to deplatform you or anyone else on the basis of political viewpoint, violating their own terms of service, you ought to be able to go to court. So give people the right to go to court and break these companies up.
So does that involve repealing Section 230?
It does. I think Section 230 right now prohibits lawsuits like that. It basically immunizes these tech companies, as you know from personal experience, in just about every circumstance that matters. And so my view is we've got to change that law, which was never meant, by the way, to protect these companies. Section 230 is a law passed in the mid-90s. There was no Facebook. There was no Google. Now these dominant platforms are using 230, these monopolies using 230, to amass power and to protect it. So we've got to give people the right to sue. We've got to change 230 to do that. But we've got to go further. I think that alone isn't enough. We've got to pair that with trust busting that will actually go in there and break these companies up and get some real competition back into our marketplace.
Well, do you have any support among colleagues?
You know, I think that Republicans are increasingly coming to understand, Republican senators and representatives are increasingly coming to understand the major threat big tech poses. I don't know how you couldn't understand it after the last year when they tried to interfere in a presidential election, when they deplatformed the sitting president of the United States, Donald Trump, back in January, when they're trying to censor our speech now. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable. Now, will the Democrats, however, be willing to actually do something that meaningfully challenges big tech's authority? I'm skeptical. I think the Democrats have fallen in love with the monopoly power of big tech for the reasons we were talking about. They can use it to censor speech and not be accountable to the First Amendment. So I think that the Democrats have a tough choice to make. They talk a lot about getting tough on monopolies, but will they actually do something about it, about these woke corporations? We'll see, but I think we've got to put them to it.
How do you put them to it?
Well, I've introduced legislation that would break the companies up, and I call it the Bust Up Big Tech Act, and it's right there in print, and it's right there in the form of a law. And so I've challenged colleagues on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, join me in this effort. If you're serious about doing something, join me in this effort. I've also introduced legislation to give people the right to sue, to make those terms of service enforceable so that if they violate their contract with you, you can sue them. And I've issued the same challenge. If you're serious, let's pass this. Join me in it. So far, I have to tell you, not very many takers. I think folks in Washington, they like to talk about this problem, but they don't really want to yet do anything about this problem.
So why would a Republican be hesitant?
Oh, well, two things, I think. For some folks, they're hesitant to take on companies that they think that constitutes intervention in the market. You know, well, this is, we're intervening in the free market. My response to that is, listen, right now, these monopolies are destroying the free market. I mean, we need to revive our free market. We need more competition to make the market truly free. The problem with monopoly power is it kills competition, and it kills the free and fair operation of the market. I think the other thing, though, Dennis, is frankly, there's a lot of influence that big tech has purchased. They have fleets of lobbyists. They've got influence with think tanks, with academics, and they've used a lot of that to try and influence Republicans and to tell them that, you know, you've got to leave big tech alone. You've got to stay away from this issue. And I think that's had an effect. And we've got to push back on that and really highlight the dangers this monopoly power poses to free speech and democracy.
They even take down doctors.
That's right, all the time. And if you don't toe the party line on any issue, whether that's about COVID-19, whether that's about other medical issues, whether that's about election integrity, religious liberty, then you're at their mercy. And again, if you don't like a decision that they make, they deplatform you and you don't like the decision, tough luck. Nothing you could do about it. You know, Facebook says, oh, you can appeal to our board. Well, we saw earlier this week, yesterday, the Facebook board is just Facebook. They're just there to bless what Facebook does.
The Facebook board.
So, exactly. It's laughable.
Right.
We've got to give people some real power.
Well, I cannot endorse your book highly enough, The Tyranny of Big Tech by Senator Josh Hawley. It is, of course, up at DennisPrager.com. Senator, it's a very important work you're doing. And I assume it's somewhat of a lonely battle. I hope when you go home to Missouri, you get reinforced emotionally to do the battle.
I do. It is a privilege to represent the state of Missouri, and it's a privilege to have the support of the people of Missouri. And my view is, Dennis, they can say whatever they want about me in Washington, D.C. I'm going to keep on representing the views of my constituents and fighting for their needs no matter what.
Well, all I can say is thank you. Senator Josh Hawley, the book, The Tyranny of Big Tech. When you were in the Obama administration, did you think at that time that the catastrophic predictions were accurate?
No.
So you were never an alarmist?
No, I never was. As I started to focus on energy matters related to climate, when I went to BP, when I was chief scientist for 5 years, I was much more concerned about energy technologies and didn't really do a hard look at the science. But, you know, my attitude was, okay, this is likely a problem, and we should be working on ways in which we might be able to deal with it. And I was focused on the energy technologies. But catastrophe, no. Come on. Anybody who knows anything about the world knows we're tremendously resilient.
So what animates people who say that, you know, we have 12 years, we're down to nine. You know, we've been, it's like, you know, you renew your car, a lease every 3 years. This is the same thing here. So Al Gore in 1990 said we had 12 years. And described it, these are the words constantly, existential threat to biological life. What animates them, since you are a prominent scientist? It is clearly not science.
Yeah. These people don't know the science. They've not read the reports. They're not scientists. And that goes for Mr. Gore and all the way on up to the people, most of the people in politics today. I like to think, again, I'm a scientist. I'm not a student of human behavior. But I like to think about this quote from H.L. Mencken, who says, you know, the purpose of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed by a series of mostly imaginary threats. And, okay, I think we can take what the politicians say with a grain of salt, but when they start invoking the science and abusing the science, that's where I think it's really bad.
That's
and
right.
It's bad.
All right.
For...
Let me hold that thought, because we must take a break. Because I want to re-announce their book, to which I am morally committed. It is titled Unsettled, What Climate Science Tells Us, What It Doesn't, and Why It Matters. Stephen Koonin.
Some of us that are conservatives had hoped, I think it was a false hope, that at some point the left was going to stop. At some point they were going to say, you know what, maybe we've gone too far. No, this is just the beginning of their plans. This is just the very start of what they plan to do to our nation and to our country. And Donald Trump, I think, only accelerated a lot of their radicalism. You see, what they used to hide, what they used to pretend did not exist, they now lead with. They now say the private part out loud because they know the media will not hold them accountable. A great example of this is the Washington Post has now completely disbanded their fact-checking division. Who needs fact-checking when the Ministry of Truth has taken over the presidency, where all they did was fact-check Donald Trump's presidency? And most of those fact-checks were basically critiques of nuance and context. They were not things that actually were necessary for massive front page fact checking, but they've disbanded their fact checking division because who needs to fact check Joe Biden? He's who they want to be put in place. But here's the thing that I think that we need to focus on the most, which is every single conservative in the country. And I'm just going to start doing this right after, I'd say late May, early June, which is every single conservative in the country needs to start showing up to these school board meetings. I think we have the tape here of this group of teachers that showed up, not teachers, this group of parents in Vail, Arizona. They just showed up to a random school board meeting and took over the school board. They fired the school board and they said, we're in charge now.
Keep up with what's trending. Subscribe on YouTube and at rumble.com.
I'm Dennis Prager, and I welcome you back, speaking to the top scientist in the Department of Energy in the Obama administration, Caltech professor. What specifically, by the way, professor of what?
I was a professor of theoretical physics at Caltech.
Oh, my God. That's right up my alley, theoretical physics. You know... When I first heard the word string theory, I thought of a Beethoven quartet. Gives you an idea where I am.
Right. Well, you know, look, we're all just people, and all I was doing was having fun. And it's what I, like most professors, that's what you like to do.
I wish most professors liked to have fun. Oh, God, that would be a better world. All right, but anyway, we'll leave it at that. Anyway, his book, ladies and gentlemen, is of unsurpassed importance at this time. It's titled Unsettled, because with a question mark, unsettled. And the question is about the whole issue of global warming, climate science, and so on. And this is from a man who was in the Obama administration and a Caltech professor, ignored completely in the world of the Washington Post, New York Times, etc. However, got a featured review in the Wall Street Journal. That was why it was my first question to the professor, and I was not surprised by his answer. Let's go to a number of the most popularized images that we get. And I think the two biggest are polar bears and glacier melting. So let's begin with polar bears. Are they disappearing?
That's not a particular subject I've studied up on, but from my casual reading, I think polar bears are doing just fine. Okay? Populations are going up.
By the way, it is indicative of your being a scientist that you would say it's not your field. But you did do your research, and it is in the book. And I'm certainly not my field, but I did a lot of reading, and that's what I have understood. Next, the melting of glaciers, both in Antarctica and Greenland.
Yeah. So, I think this is something that there's some popular misconception about. I've got a graph in the book from a very recently published paper that tries to tease apart all of the things that are causing sea level to rise. And what you see is that the glaciers were high in terms of melting about 60 years ago, and then they went down, and now they're starting to go up again. All right, but not quite as high as they were, let's say, in 1950. And so there's a lot of variability here. The glacier melting depends on a lot of different things, not just the temperature. And if we look at just the last 20 years and get all excited because, it's going up, it's melting faster, you really have to put that in some historical and geological perspective. The same is true for Greenland. Again, I'm looking at this graph in the book, and it was melting more in 1940, say, than it was a few years ago. And, it may be going up again. It's very variable. The exact causes of that variability, we don't understand. And so we shouldn't get too excited. Climate is a 30-year average. And let us step back a little bit and stop confusing weather with climate or natural variability with human influences, and really take a longer-term view of these things.
What is your reaction to the constantly stated argument, 97% of scientists agree, and then fill in the rest on climate science?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the 97% number comes from a ridiculously distorted survey of some published papers. It's been thoroughly debunked, and again, there are references in the book to the debunking. But even beyond that, what are we supposed to be agreeing or disagreeing about? If you ask me if the globe is warmed by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the last century, absolutely. If you ask me whether carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is going up because we're burning fossil fuels, absolutely. If you ask me whether that is exerting a warming influence on the globe, sure. But is that the only cause of warming, or is that going to lead to a catastrophe? I'm not there at all.
That's the issue. It's what I said from the beginning. I'm just telling my listeners. Never denied it's getting warmer. Never denied that carbon dioxide might play a role. But the question is it catastrophic?
Yeah.
So where are these modeling predictions of catastrophe coming from?
Well, there are probably 20 different modeling centers around the world, and they build and run these very large, complex computer models. They're all different. They all give different results. And then they feed in assumptions about what future emissions are going to look like, and hence future temperatures. But even as the temperature is rising, And the economic impact of the rising temperatures is expected to be minimal, according to the reports. And again, not Steve talking, but the official UN and U.S. government reports. So I don't understand where climate catastrophe comes from.
Well, from somebody who has at least as many credentials as you, a young woman named Thornburg.
Oh, right. Well, you know, I've read her book, and I hope she reads mine. And maybe someday yes. she and I can have a conversation.
No, you're a professor of theoretical physics at Caltech. She's a teenage girl, and she gets the attention, and you don't.
That's fine. I never set out for attention when I sat down to write this book. I really, again, just wanted to explain to people and see the eyes light up when they finally understand, which is what I've been doing as an educator for 30 or 40 years.
Do you have any, do you have any thoughts about the objective of getting the country off fossil fuels by 2030 or 2040?
Yeah. So it's good to sort of say a little more precisely what the proposals are.
All right. So hold on. I don't want to interrupt you. I want to have your full thoughts on that when we come back. Again, I'm speaking to a professor of theoretical physics, Caltech. He was the head scientist in the Department of Energy in the Obama administration. My suspicion is he's a lifelong Democrat. I'm not gonna go there with him unless he wants to note it. But that's I just want you to understand where he's coming from. This notion of the settled science, 97% agree, existential threat. None of it is true. None of it is true. That's how important I consider it. The book is Unsettled? What climate science tells us, what it doesn't, why it matters. Stephen Koonin was the top scientist in the Department of Energy in the Obama administration. Former professor of physics at theoretical physics, to be precise, at Caltech. And now a professor. We didn't establish a professor of what at NYU?
Well, you know, when I went to NYU, because I'd been a provost at Caltech, I had kind of been fed up with the academic tribalism. And I said, I don't want to be a professor of anything. I just want to be a professor. And the provost at the time, a nice guy whom I know well, Dave McLaughlin, said, you got to be a professor of something. So I'm in the civil engineering department. I'm in the business school in technology and operations, and I've got an appointment in physics as well.
Nice. So the data that you gave at the end of the last segment were staggering. If we did nothing, maybe the temperature of the world would increase 1 or 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit.
No, centigrade.
Oh, I thought you said Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Okay.
No. That's a little more. It's about 2.5 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right. And let's say that happened. What would the results be for humanity?
Well, given that we've gone up by 1 degree centigrade or 2 Fahrenheit already since 1900, roughly, and the world has prospered, it's not such a big deal, okay? And even the IPCC says that. The official reports say for a temperature rise of even up to 7 or 8 degrees Fahrenheit, the economic impact is minimal for the U.S. and the globe. Okay, minimal. In the book you can find the exact text.
I'll put you on the spot, Anna, but yep. You're certainly free to say anything. So when we're told that Manhattan will be underwater, fires will engulf the planet, the Antarctic ice sheet will melt and rise seas 7 feet, would you characterize these as lies?
I would characterize them as gross exaggerations.
Right.
You know, with the sea level at the Battery in Manhattan, just to take that example, is going up. It has been going up since 1850, and it's been going up at 1 foot a century. Now, you know, the IPCC will say, well, right, in the next 80 years, it could going up a little
Listen,
more
rapidly. Listen, I want to thank you for a magnificent hour and a magnificent book.
Okay.